Emil is an illusionary child whose learned autism allows him to be free. The story of Emil is an example of how the absolute absence of desire creates free-willed individuals, but simultaneously, in order to become a free and caring individual human being, Rousseau believed Emil needed to learn to become an entity in control of his senses. In Rousseau's term, the misery of mankind does not reveal itself of what is missing, but because of the urge with which this missing is felt. For an individual, in order to live according to his own free will, it is absolutely essential to remain untouched by the constructed desires of society, hence need nobody to reach his goals, but relies on himself entirely. According to Rousseau, it follows that not power and authority are the highest goods that can be gained, but are freedom. In terms of this free will, Rousseau believed that only compassion and not order and authority, of course, such socially naive ideas, could prevent people from killing each other. Compassion itself, something natural to human beings, does not necessarily coincide with human upbringing, which Rousseau considers as quite unnatural, at least in his time. Part of the problem seems to be that one cannot be raised a human being and a civilian at the same time, according to Rousseau. Emil, his imaginary pupil, is raised according to the principle of natural experience. He is thought not to be frightened of the distance, of the frightening faces, blasts of cannon, and nor of pain. We seem to lack such virtues, and by chance we can only be seduced to such compassion through the dramas over which we sob, which equally maintain a distance embodied by illusion. Rousseau was wrong, of course. Nobody wants to be in Emile's shoes, and especially not as his mother's shoes. It was truly possible to program a child in the way Rousseau believes it to be, and many people agree with him on this exaggerated parental influence. Emile would probably, having Rousseau as a father, undergo psychoanalysis for the rest of his natural life. But Rousseau's alternative to the lack of compassion equals a long tradition of belief which entails that one does not do unto others such as one would not do unto oneself. In Rousseau's view, experience of the lesson comes before teaching the lessons. He teaches Emile not to be frightened of anything. But the question remains if Emile would really be able to live that long, as the fact that one is free from fear means absolutely no insurance that crude domination from the outside world would not exist. Rather, I tend to agree with you that Emil would grow up with the objective ironic presentment that the category, labeled as child, into which he has been subjectified does not really exist. You have posed this to be the case for women, children, and animals. It is exactly because this objective ironic presentment, this otherness which ensures Emil's individual perception and which enables him to possess a double strategy. The secret is that at some level the child knows that he is not a child, but the adult does not know that. And those are your words. Some children are not as lucky as Emil, though. As to some, let's call them creatures, the society of human beings is not very appealing. In your view, they are somewhat unable to reconcile with Western society, but their otherness is not really appreciated a lot. In fact, it is a feared reality principle which does not compute with the illusion of a modern Western democratic civilization. To apply your description of the state of affairs, So long as there is otherness, strangeness, and the possibly violent dual relation, as we have seen in anthropological accounts up until the 18th century and into the colonial phase, there is no racism properly so called. Once that natural relations is lost, we enter into a phobic relationship with the artificial other, idealized by hatred. And because it is an ideal other, this relationship is an exponential one. Nothing can stop it, since the whole trend of our culture is towards a fantastically pursued differential construction, a perceptual extrapolation of the same from the other. Or as you put it bluntly, autistic culture by dint of fake altruism. Now, although I don't believe that idolizing time up until the 18th century will help us a lot here. Now, I know that you are not really interested in criticizing psychoanalysis, but what I'm referring at is a double-bind relationship imposed on individuals concerning two positions held towards the relation between the self and the other. The first position holds that we are able to know the other by giving up our subjectivity, sacrificing ourselves. The second position holds that we can understand the other by sacrificing him, her, to our objectivity. Psychoanalysis basically only toys with these positions, and the fact that it is able to do so is a plain result of the unbearable cultural situation of denial for the sake of the good of individuals. Even happiness is not considered to be unhappy faith of them others, who are categorized as being non-sensitive. I would like to exemplify this here, not because I think examples would confirm or deny your ideas, but simply because it is an exemplification of how, in this case, Western culture deals with sensitivity. For that, I want to describe how autistic children are viewed by some scientists. Warning up front should function here. I do not want to give any statement about the nature of autistic children. I solely want to show how some social scientists have dealt with autistic children in their firm belief that they were themselves true superior sensitive human beings. What applies here could be the other side of racism. The humanitarian seeks the other just as desperately in the form of victims to aid. Idealization plays for better or for worse. The scapegoat is no longer the person you bound, but the one whose lot you lament. Therefore, by now, it should not strike anybody as a coincidence that Bruno Bettelheim could launch autism in children as their concealed lacking of stimuli. More frightening, he also believed that autistic children suffer from a lack of sensitivity towards impulses from their own body, as well as impulses from the external world. Many people believed Bettelheim until a rather negative biography about him appeared only recently. The fact that this biography seems to pose questions towards the man's psychoanalytic work does not withstand the fact that his theories are part of a mainstream of psychiatric evaluation of autistic children since the middle of the 20th century. They did not come from Bettelheim alone, but they were part of an explanatory model on the growth of children which was equally used by Karl Popper, and still is all around present within Western society. The bottom line of such theories is that they assume people to be born as relatively blank creatures, to be filled with buckets of humanity in the course of their upbringing. This seems a Rousseau image, but their emphasis is less focused on teaching compassion than it is towards mastering language, and with it, mastering human relations. Also, Rousseau believed people to be born with a natural capacity for compassion. Bettelheim has created a category of autism in a classical way, classic to this century indeed, as autistic children from the absolute category of the unsensed, who remain quiet and do not talk back to us in any God-given way. In Bettelheim's time, the unity of the sensorium was already lost. Would this not have been the case? Autistic children, to whom I from here on now will refer to as anything but autistic, might have been classified as hypersensitive instead of insensitive. As it stood, Bettelheim simplified the matter by reducing the senses to the alleged complexity of uttering language. In his book, Empty Fortress, his definition of the personality of autistic children states that they do not potentialize their abilities because... Well, they probably do not experience the world as the infant does. What they experience is not mediated through a complex personality, or at least not as complex as in normal children. Well, too complex for us to understand, I would add, but it gets worse in Bettelheim's statements that... What first disturbed me and aroused my interest in these children was how deliberate they seem to turn their back on humanity and society. In fact, Bettelheim is disturbed by their strangeness and otherness of autistic children from his idea of humanity and society, and therefore he concludes that... Autistic children withdraw from the world before their humanity ever really develops. Lacking such humanity, Bettelheim concludes that autistic children are very unhappy. Every activity they engage in is empty. They so have alienated themselves from the experience of time that only empty space remains. Further implication of the constructed otherness of autistic children comes from Bettelheim's comparison with people called Muslims in the former concentration camps. Under the daily threat of death and pain, these Muslims were camp prisoners who had fully withdrawn from the world. They became apathic, incommunicative, and were avoided by fellow prisoners out of fear for contamination of their behavior. More othering, as self-alienation is implied by Bettelheim's view on what he believed to be self-expression. We have little doubt that as speech develops in child destined to become autistic, his psychic reality becomes more painful and leads him to turn destructively on his capacity for verbal thought. Some do so to the degree of turning mute, while others only put a stop to spontaneous expression and resort to the repetition of songs or statements once heard. In doing so, they abstain from phrasing their own thoughts and express them only on the words of others. The true Western equivalent of mind reading on Bettelheim's part, and this I do mean sarcastic. I could give many more examples from Bettelheim's book, but in all honesty, it angers me. Bettelheim's entire category of autism is coinciding with an unbearable cultural situation of denial for the sake of the good of individuals. Even happiness is considered to be unhappy fate of them, others, who are categorized as being non-sensitive. No real choice is given to autistic children in the matter, for Bettelheim assumes up front they have none, unless he himself interferes. The irony of this cultural image is the blunt dependency created between self and other in an absolute manner, that is. Just as language develops only if we wish to talk to someone or to understand what he is telling us, so personality develops only if we wish to do something with another human being. Truly a complete eradication of sensing, and all of it based on the alleged desire to communicate. Strangely, though, what autistic children do express, if we turn the spectrum slightly away from Bettelheim's category of non-sensitive, is given to us by the language of autistic children. They refrain themselves from using the I, while substituting it with you or he. According to Bettelheim, this linguistic twist shows no awareness of selfhood, and some awareness of the selfhood of others. In my view, it shows absolute awareness of the selfhood of others. It could very well be that sensitive children might feel that being identified with the projection of the I image coming from the speaker has little to do with what they are. They might utter you, referring to what the speaker believes them to be saying. I refuse to be your mirror. As such, it could equally be an expression of ultimate individual awareness of one's own body being different from the category of the other. The opposite of being autistic. The ultimate irony is that sensitive people are so extremely aware of the complicated function of language in society, as this function has established the social as an interdependent selfhood. Yet, on top of that, and in spite of their sensitivity, Bettelheim transfers the whole of society onto the motives of autistic individuals by stating on their capacity for memory and repetition. Firstly, repetition avoids any personal commitment, and secondly, it divulges or only a minimum about the inner thoughts that they feel. Now, remember what you said about the other. The other is what allows me not to repeat myself forever. And this forces us to conclude that language is both deaf and mute. Sensitive children may be able to understand this simple yet complex aspect of language at much earlier age than we could ever do. I must stress here that I do not believe for a moment that this is the result of a parental background. Neither is it a matter of the body of the other, nor of the individual body perception. It is the result of language, the language we apply to categorize the difference. The history of autism reveals more of the history of language and the underlying image of the sensorium than it does about autistic children. Against the rationalizing attempts to decimate both language and communication into a impossible relation between the bodies of others as interjection of the individual perception, or an impossible relation between the individual body and the objectified other, I rather believe autistic children to have a commitment towards sensing the lucidity of communication in ways our human society fears more than anything else, and such general rejection of communication within human society once brought to awareness seemed to scare the shit out of psychoanalysts. Bettelheim is a frightening example of what happens if a general view of the body sensorium is subjected to the belief in categorical communication. It could be that sensitive children were given a glimpse of the vortex into the universe of real time and were shocked to see the illusions by which the rest of mankind communicates. Now I ask you, which person is deaf, mute, and unhappy? Most likely sensitive children sense more than most humans do, or at least did in Bettelheim circles. If they are labeled as autistic, this label reflects our own rational fear of sensitivity. Of course, such sane recognition of sensitivity only happens quite little at a time. If we were to extend our knowledge of autistic to other fields within society, that in itself would mean the end of the greatest illusion of all, illusion of sense control. This, of course, will not come around, as the illusion of sense control repeats itself as a never-ending story. Didn't repetition indeed. More than variants of the belief in sense control are composed of courses in sensitivity training. These courses arose in the 60s and were featured by a laboratory approach composed from T groups, training groups, in which people could learn to be communicative. They do not differ from Rousseau's basic idea of independence and compassion. Teaching proudly announces that sensitivity training is not a panacea for all ills of our time, then. It is, however, a powerful means of helping free individuals to become more of what and how they wish to be. Even more popular nowadays in American culture are training courses in which white people undergo a short period of black treatment to experience what it is like to be discriminated. Such is the belief that this process would enhance better understanding about a deplorable situation of underprivileged groups in society. And with fervent enthusiasm, it is now being employed as a teaching method with young children. Overstimulating the sensorium with impulses of a certain kind is well established as a teaching method. However, the ideology behind the teaching does not teach the ideology behind it. To teach the experience of suffering also teaches the capacity of power. I have seen numerous subjects of sensitivity training who had learned not compassion, but instead gained exact knowledge on dominating their surroundings by employing sensitivity techniques. These are the ones who viewed the training as a simulation. Equally, I have met equal amounts of victims from sensitivity training who never again in their life were capable of defending themselves against the exploitive domination of others. These were the ones who took it for real. Furthermore, we shouldn't forget that Rousseau at least trained Emile as an individual through an individual relation and not to a group confrontation, as he believed it not to be possible to simultaneously raise Emile as a good human being and a good civilian. Group processes always, without exceptions, imply the means of conformism, as Solomon Asch has shown us. And so it seems that you are right in saying this distance is vital, for without it we would perceive nothing. Everything would be totally crowded together, as it doubtless was the primal state of the world, the only state we can say existed in real time, since all matter was coexistent with itself, present to itself at a single point and a single moment. Once that initial and perfectly hypothetical state came to an end, the illusion of the world began. But again, this is not real time anymore. These are appliances of distance and proximity, which seems to implicate life or death for individual perception, but simultaneously never cross beyond the boundaries of the psychodrama. In real life, of course, the oppressed is the one who survives oppression by changing its direction, hence creating a safe distance between the oppressed and the oppressor. proximity and distance also have a long tradition of alteration, by which both phenomena have been replaced as body interlocutors. Though studies in body behavior still apply the categories of proximity and distance to a space between bodies, in terms of the sensorium, they have been replaced by the psychological and medical connotations of internal and external processes. These internal and external processes have been transformed into illusionary internal and external worlds, and in itself, this process did not start with Freud or Foucault, but at the very moment of the creation of time as we know it, and with it the perception of bodies as individual entities seem to have been destroyed forever. In trying to liberate us from Foucault, you wrote, "Nowadays one no longer says, 'You got a soul, you must save it,' but 'You got a sexual nature and you must find out how to use it well. You have got an unconscious and you must learn how to liberate it. You got a body and you must know how to enjoy it. You got a libido and you must know how to spend it,' etc., etc." Which really brought a smile to my face, but at the same time confirmed my rather pessimistic feeling that we are never allowed to be what we are, as we are always the illusion of what we seem to want to be or expected to be. And, as such, we have created the fall of man with the creation of illusion, the illusion of being non-sensing individuals. The idea that we are non-sensing individual bodies has been strengthened by the thought of a gene program, as essentialists uphold, or a historical conditioning, as the constructivists uphold. Both streams are, of course, mere poles of the same opposition, and though we live in an illusionary time model, this model is nevertheless determining the range of perceptions and motivation taught to us as the ones we should be liberated from. And that model? That model composes a flagrant, ridiculous diaper, fit only to catch the rather disposable products of rationality and pose them off as traces of a rather limited range of motivations from real life. Levi-Strauss once compared the unconscious as always empty, like the stomach, and only reacts on the food which surpasses it, but reality might reveal no more than the emptiness of the model, the structure which could be filled with whatever content you'll fill it, or whatever the body can produce. Indeed, the mere fact of causal process enables such an incredible material luxuriousness. This cannot withstand that the essence of individual humans must be somewhere. In fact, nothing might happen in real time except the fact that the active presence of the individual body allows it. We might even decide to call it dream time, and it would still be a rather human concept, as the Australian Aboriginals lived with the notion for quite some time. Personally, I think we have milked causality long enough, so let's return to the point where this game of motivation first seemed to have started, and have a look at Foucault's analysis on the work of Artemidori's interpretation of the predictive dream. For in spite of the fact that rational science seemed to trace the origin and causes, the binding motivational factors have always come from interpretation, and the interpretation of the prophetic dreams of individual bodies.